W62DR Oshkosh, and WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. A U.S. official confirming two people dead after a Black Hawk helicopter belonging to the Tennessee National Guard crashed onto an Alabama highway. El Paso, Texas police say one person has died and three others hurt in a shooting at a local mall. Buffalo supermarket mass shooter Peyton Gendron sentenced to life in prison without parole. It was an emotional hearing that included victim impact statements from family members of the 10 black residents killed.
In the end, the judge said that there would be no mercy, that his crimes were too cruel, too heinous, and she sentenced Peyton Gendron to what was required, life in prison without the possibility of parole after he had pleaded guilty to domestic terrorism motivated by hate.
ABC's Aaron Katursky. Michigan State University campus gathering for a vigil for the victims of a Monday night mass shooting.
It is okay to not be okay right now.
Undergraduate student body president Joe Kovach. This is ABC News. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says there's more to do to help Ukraine fight the Russian invasion.
In NATO countries, a problem. Ammunition reserves are running down due to the handover to Kyiv. That means individual alliance nations will now have to pay for more to replenish those losses. Defense Secretary Austin.
We also discussed our progress in building up ammunition stockpiles and boosting defense industrial capacity.
A year down the road, we're still hearing the phrase, we'll support Ukraine for as long as it takes. But that point of view is starting to wear thin among some in Europe. Tom Rivers, ABC News at the Foreign Desk.
West Virginia lawmakers giving the final approval to a bill that would establish an annual day of recognition for the plane crash that killed most of the Marshall University football team. Rare footage of a 1986 dive through the wreckage of the RMS Titanic is now available to the public on YouTube. Andy Field, ABC News.
You're listening to a Civic Media radio station. To learn more, go to our website, civicmedia.us.
This is Civic Media for the Fox Valley.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Governor Evers wants to boost public schools funding by a little more than $2.5 billion. The governor's full budget proposal is released tonight. It would lift revenue limits and increase money for special education and mental health services. Evers also wants to provide breakfast and lunch at school for all students. Republicans who control the legislature's Joint Finance Committee will spend the weeks and months ahead likely changing the governor's proposals by quite a bit. The woman accused of killing and dismembering a man in Green Bay last year is causing more trouble. At a court hearing yesterday, Taylor Shabusiness elbowed her lawyer in the head. A bailiff tackled Shabusiness and they scuffled until she was handcuffed. Yesterday's hearing was to determine if she's competent to stand trial. It's been rescheduled. In sports, the Bucks beat the Celtics in overtime last night. The Badgers beat Michigan. Tonight, Marquette hosts Xavier. I'm Terry Bell. And this, Civic Media News.
Wisconsin spring primary election is Tuesday, February 21st, and your local civic media radio station will be tracking the results.
Special live coverage starts at 7 p.m. and News Director Terry Bell with a team of political experts will be following which candidates, both local and in the state Supreme Court race, move on to April.
Spring primary election coverage live. Tuesday, February 21st, starting at 7, here on your local Civic Media radio station, streaming on the Civic Media app.
I was just curious as to why you called it the Paul Revere Show.
The Paul Revere Show is named this way because the poem that we all know, the famous ride, the poem was written to rally the troops to fight slavery and fight for democracy. And so I named the show the Paul Revere Show because I thought it was the time to get on the air and talk about democracy.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m., always on the Civic Media app.
Catch Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow at its brand new time, 6 to 8 a.m. weekdays.
the city of Shanghai started administering an inhalable COVID-19 vaccine. I hear a lot of you saying the same thing I had in my head. I don't know about that.
As long as they're not just crop dusting everyone.
Crop dusting, that's exactly what I think people would be fearful of. I would not trust the Chinese government. I would trust people who really know about inhaling something and the good that it does you. Of course, I'm talking about Dom and Crute.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
J.R. Radcliffe is coming back to the show. The timeline of Brett Favre's involvement in a welfare scam in Mississippi.
Brett Favre's camp has denied all wrongdoing. He really feels like he did nothing wrong. So I guess he's a little burned by that.
Celebrating all things Wisconsin. As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 11 to 2 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
Go by any construction site in Wisconsin, you're going to see a lot of Michael's trucks. Since 2014, they've had more than $1 billion worth of contracts with the state government.
A large part of those coming with Foxconn without any results in that area.
Do we want a governor who might be giving his brothers the contract? I think he needs to answer that before the election.
We'll just kick that one down the road. We'll cross that bridge when we get to it. But of course, Michael's corporation would get to build that said bridge.
Listen, Monday through Friday from 2 to 3, it's Dueling Tangents.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, I go back to this derailment. And the sad reality is it didn't catch media attention until, you know, somebody thought they could use it as a political issue to harm the other side. And look, there are a lot of questions. As I said at the start, this is corporate greed. This is a government that isn't on the ball. These are unions that have been hamstrung by decades of attacks. These are small towns that are getting screwed over. This is like the last throes of capitalism. This is stuff you would think you'd heard back in the 80s and 90s, and not the 1980s and 90s. But that's why I've asked Greg Regan to come talk with us. Greg is the president of the Transportation Trades Department of the AFL-CIO. Greg, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. Happy to be here.
So I'm looking at this, and I got to tell you, there's a lot of blame to go around. I'm not fond of the response out of the administration. I'm not fond of the fact that we over the summer heard all kinds of reports of safety concerns on the rails, workers that wanted to strike that the administration stopped. There's so much here, so much to blame. What should we be focused on right now?
I think we should be focused on the fact that we got lucky here. I think that's as bluntly as I can put it. The fact that we have derailments at an alarming rate around this country, we have a degrading safety culture in the railroad industry, and we just end up in a situation where the wrong rail cars derailed at the wrong place and the wrong time, and we somehow end up with zero casualties and zero serious injuries. That's lucky. So what we do next with this, how we actually take this close call and take meaningful reform steps, that's the important part. That's the important part from my perspective.
Yeah, I saw a statistic said, I guess 2022, there were 1,022 derailments. I don't think I heard of any of those.
No, and look, there were two just in the week since this derailment occurred. And in one of them, there was a fatality down in Houston, and it also involved hazardous materials. But the driver of a truck who caused the derailment of a freight train down outside of Houston, he unfortunately passed away. This stuff is not rare for the men and women who operate our train system. In many cases, it's sort of the luck of the draw about how severe it's going to be.
No, and that's the scary part of this. And you brought up hazmat. The sad reality is the statistic I saw is over a 5-year period, I think it was 14 through 18, the amount of hazardous material violations went up like 36%. I'm just trying to remember the statistic, but it's off the charts. And you go, why is that happening? How is that allowed to happen? And is it because maybe we've gotten rid of so many people who maybe it was their job to ensure that that those things were in compliance? I don't know. I'm curious.
Well, I can tell you certainly from the workers' perspective about what the members that I talk to on the ground, what they say is they have seen, you know, if you, when you lay off a third of your workforce over the course of 7 years, that has a tangible effect on safety culture. It has a tangible effect on what is expected of workers, on the speed they're expected to turn things around in. And it is, you know, whether it's a derailment that has no tangible impact, where maybe it's just a delay, or you have something like this, where you have to evacuate an entire town, we should be treating all of those the same. Because again, there is a luck of the draw aspect about what cars derail make a major difference in terms of what the actual consequences are. And I want to say sort of more broadly, freight rail still is the safest way to move most of these hazardous materials across the country. We have to move them. We have to deliver them from where they're produced to where we are going to use them for manufacturing and other purposes. Freight rail remains the safest way to do it. And the men and women who are doing that work are highly trained and highly effective at it. This is an outlier of a situation, but it doesn't mean we should ever stop in our ability to try to make this situation safer. So when we talk about risks and possible problems in freight rail and possible safety risks, it's because we want the best, most effective and growing freight rail system we possibly can have.
No, we need it. I mean, we desperately need to have the ability to move products across this country. And rail, as you pointed out, is the safest, also probably the cheapest way of doing it, the most environmentally sound, if you will, as well. Mm-hmm. But the sad reality is, in talking with my friend Jared Cassidy from the Smart Union, we have seen massive reductions in the number of employees, especially as trains have gotten larger. One government accountability office report says that trains have grown 25% from a decade ago. The fact that trains are getting bigger, fewer people are doing it, and you've got this precision scheduled railroading that really has thrown a bunch of monkey wrenches into this. And the fact that, as Jared pointed out, inspection times have been cut in half to where now you got 90 seconds to do a 120-point inspection. I don't know how you do that.
No, and that is a major problem. I mean, we cannot continue in the direction we're going right now. And I don't think it's a coincidence. And of course, we can't prove causation with this, but the correlation of when we've seen the reductions in workforce levels and when we've seen the rates of accidents and incidents, both on the railroads and in the rail yards, have increased dramatically, 10% increase, when you would think that as we start to get better technology, better information, better training, that we should be decreasing the rates of incidents and accidents. But that's actually been the opposite direction. And this is me speaking, but I cannot imagine that drastic reductions in workforce and the strain that you're putting on that workforce don't have a major cause to play in all of this.
No, I mean, I agree. And here's the thing. I go back to the number of people on a train. When I was a kid, there were a bunch of people on the train. There were several people on the caboose. There were people in the middle. There were people on the train. Now we've got two people on a train that, 5 miles long? How is that? I know we've got detectors around along the way and all of that, but it's been reported that this train was on fire for 20 miles. I got to imagine if you had people on that train, they'd have smelled, seen, felt something. Maybe you just got it stopped soon. Who knows? I'm just saying that having more eyes and ears is not a worse thing.
No, it's definitely not. And I would also want to point out, while the broader industry had a 30% reduction in their workforce, 45,000 people over the past 8 years. Union Pacific was one of the worst offenders. They had a 40% reduction of their workforce during that time. So they've been most aggressive in terms of their furloughing and reduction of the workforce. And, while we can never point to, until we find out what happened with the with this particular derailment, until the National Transportation Safety Board comes out with their findings, I can't comment on what caused it, what would have prevented it, right, all that stuff. But I can tell you about what people are saying about the broader safety culture and the problems we're seeing on the ground that contribute to a number of incidents across the country. Again, and you can point to the next two that happened this week afterwards.
Yeah, well, what they said in their report today is that what they came out with, and I'm sure you've seen this as well, that it was a wheel bearing in the final stages of overheat failure. And the only reason they caught that is because there was a residential surveillance camera that picked it up, moments before it derailed. This we know. So we know we know what I suspected all along. We now know that to be the case. Whether an inspection would have saved that, whether, you know, having more time than 90 seconds to look over a car, would have helped, I don't know. But I can't imagine it would have not been I can't imagine it wouldn't have not been helpful.
No, you're right. And you know, the other thing that I've pointed to that we've called for since this accident happened is, you know, there is a program at the Federal Railroad Administration, the Confidential Close Call Reporting System. This is modeled after similar systems in the aviation community where pilots and in this case, railroad workers can say, oh, man, that was close. We almost had a real problem there. It was on this turn of this track. And so we should have a flag for that. Or they can flag when they felt some deterioration in one of the systems, the cars. You know, basically, they can feel free to report this stuff without any fear of reprisal from their employer. That works great in the aviation system. What we learned is that in the railroad system, you need your employers to participate, voluntarily participate in that program. Without the employer's participation, you lose that protection as an employee to report these problems without fear of reprisal. So we have this all set up. Amtrak participates, commuter rail systems participate, none of the Class 1 freight railroads participate. So while I can't point to the fact that this could have prevented something, but I think there's a real missed opportunity when we're not collecting that data, when we're not getting that worker input into where the problem areas are in our freight rail system. So I hope that we're looking at this near miss. And again, while there may be long-term consequences, this was a near miss when it came to actual deaths, that we are going to take a very hard look at how do we make this system safer.
Yeah, I hope so. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Greg Regan, president of the Transportation Trades Department of the VFL-CIO, ttd.org, the website. We'll get links out on social media. I can take a look at that. Now, everyone's focused on the fact that they blew up portions of this train. And I've had people say that, you know, they blew it up so that they could open the train lines faster, a whole bunch of you know, nefarious reasons. Is there a reason that they blew this up?
Yeah, from what I've been told, it was a controlled release to burn it out to prevent I think it's a blevy explosion is the technical, it's an acronym, where you can have a really massive explosion if you don't actually try to control the pressure inside one of these tanks. And that was the decision that was made. From the conversations I had, I'm not sure if that was, no one's making a commentary on whether that was the right decision, the wrong decision, but it was done based on the risk assessment on the ground, that there were other cars at risk which could have had a, you know, a chain reaction of explosions. There were a number of things that could have happened, but they didn't put explosives to the train car, which was another option, it's my understanding.
Yeah, because you see that giant, you know, that big plume of smoke. You wonder, was this the right thing to do, the wrong thing, especially as it's going to be spread over miles and affecting people. I also wanted to ask you about our infrastructure, because you talked about, you know, around certain track areas. You know, when you look at the fact that, you know, we've got aging infrastructure, how much of these derailments, maybe not this one in particular, or maybe, because again, we don't know, you know, what condition are our freight rails in? And is this something that, because I know I'm told repeatedly that the industry, you know, upkeeps their rails and it's supposed to be, you know, one of the best in the globe. I'm curious thoughts.
Look, I think our freight rail system, it needs a lot of investment in general. I think we need modern rail cars. I think we need to make more investment into capacity, certainly, and to modernizing the federal infrastructure law that is putting a lot of money into our supply chain system is going to make a number of investments that are not going to be, you know, checks cut to the railroads, but it's going to be checks cut to municipalities and states that are where the investment is going to directly benefit the railroads. So we're talking about grade crossing improvements. We're talking about expanding access to ports. We're talking about intermodal facilities. All of these things are not checks that are going to be cut to Union Pacific or Norfolk Southern or any of those companies, but they're going to be the beneficiaries of a possible expanded marketplace. So I hope that they are going to be willing to match that type of investment in their own infrastructure to meet the needs and to make the system safer. While they will very much tout their own investment in their systems, and they'll give you big raw numbers, But as a percentage of revenue and as a percentage of operation, that continues to drop. So that's where I have a real problem with their assessment of their own investment, their own, largesse into their own system.
Yeah, because, I look at this from the outside, and again, we've moved to this system that corporations get to police themselves. And I look at this, just massive corporate greed that we've seen over the last several decades. I look at Norfolk Southern, extremely profitable, $4.8 billion profit in 2022. And the stock buybacks and all of the stuff that go into this, where you go, this is stuff that could have gone into upgrading your equipment. This is stuff that could have gone to hiring more workers. I look back over the summer. It's not that these railroads couldn't give their workers 15 paid sick days. It's not that they couldn't answer a lot of the safety questions and alleviate those things. It's because they didn't want to and they didn't have to. And sadly, we had an administration that didn't have their back and the workers' back in that moment. So for me, the problem is multifaceted and across the board.
Well, I would disagree that the administration didn't have the workers back in this moment, because let's be perfectly clear. If we hadn't had the action from this administration last year, last summer, we would still be at the bargaining table and all these workers would not have had a single raise. And while I agree with you that there was not enough done in that presidential emergency board report, which again, those are independent arbitrators. They're not at the control of the president. That broke the dam in terms of actually getting to an agreement that 8 of the 12 unions ratified, by the way. And while I think there were a lot of things left on the cutting room floor that shouldn't have been, including sick days, I think that the end result was a massive step in the right direction for a number of areas. And when I point to issues that I think are plaguing the industry right now, staffing is the number one problem. The fact that they furloughed this many people is the number one problem. That is the reason why sick days became an issue. That's the reason why the attendance policies are so draconian, because they need people to work all the time because they don't have anybody else to take those shifts. Those are all problems that are a direct result of the business practices that were furloughing so many of the workforce. And unfortunately, while I would love to have a collective bargaining agreement that solves all these problems, it only covers the people that are employed. And they don't have enough people employed. And that's the underlying issue. And so until they start addressing things like sick leave, and we saw some progress on that last week, and hopefully that will continue. And still we start addressing the attendance policies and start getting some sort of morale correction and some sort of work-life balance correction on the railroads, then we're not going to be able to build the workforce where we can actually have, to recruit and retain people that are needed to do this in the best possible way.
No, I'm with you. And look, I gave the administration credit for doing the things that you pointed out. But ultimately, I thought they could have messaged this better. I knew there was never going to be a strike. That was never going to be allowed to happen. But I think the messaging could have gotten better.
That's fair. That is fair. One thing I do also want to point out, when we're talking about sort of the response to this particular incident, far too often in transportation, where, I represent so many workers, the major safety reforms that are made are done because something really awful happened. Think about the Colgan air crash in aviation in 2009. That was the fourth accident in a matter of only 6 or 7 years. We had a number of people pass away in commercial aviation where planes falling out of the skies. And it spurred some major reforms in terms of pilot training, fatigue rules, and other issues that made it so that we would improve the safety of the system. And guess what? It worked. I mean, despite the fact that some people right now are trying to pare back some of those training requirements, but we haven't had a U.S. aircraft fall out of the sky since then. It's the safest period in the history of U.S. aviation after those reforms were made. We were given a gift with this one because we had a major high-profile problem that fortunately didn't kill people. So let's seize that opportunity and for once not have a regulation or new safety regulations be written in blood. This is our opportunity right now. That would be my message to every member of Congress, everybody in the regulatory facilities. And frankly, that's what our unions are going to be carrying forward right now.
That is an excellent point. Again, all we hear from my friends on the right is job-killing regulation. And I always ask, what about the people-killing lack of regulation? This is one of those moments. But Greg, I appreciate the time. As always, I hope you'll come back as this continues and keep us up to date.
You got it. Thanks, Rick.
Thanks so much. Greg Regan, president of the Transportation Trades Department of the AFL-CIO, ttd.org, the website. Got to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. Give us another Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
If you're a fan of the show, you've heard our Labor History in Two segments, and you can hear them on the radio pretty much anywhere in the U.S. Labor history has never been more important than it is right now. So here's what we'd like you to do. Tell a teacher. Tell a teacher that labor history is important and that they can get digestible two-minute lessons that are absolutely free. Free to download, free to use, free to share. Tell a teacher to go to thericksmithshow.com/history and help us put labor back where it belongs, in the classroom. You know, generations of American workers fought, bled, and died to build the American way of life. It's our job to keep their stories alive. Go tell a teacher that we're here to help them do just that. Find us at thericksmithshow.com/history today.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So interesting a little bit. Bernie Sanders, chair of the HELP Committee. Health, Education, Labor, and Pension. Evidently, it says that Howard Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks, has refused to testify in front of his panel and answer the question, you know, why he's you know, doing all the things he's doing, why over 75 unfair labor practices have been filed with the National Labor Relations Board for him violating federal labor law. Now, the weird thing is, again, I go back to, and this is one of those moments. You know, had Hillary Clinton become president, he probably would have been the labor secretary. And again, this is another one of those moments where, look, I want Democrats to stand up and fight for working people. This was an opportunity for the Biden administration and for Pete Buttigieg. So there's some stuff here to really take a lead. And I know my friends are going to be really angry. It's the state's responsibility. It's Governor DeWine in Ohio. It's Governor Shapiro here in Pennsylvania. Shapiro was out in front of this. DeWine evidently said, no, go on back. Everything's fine. Again, kind of a... And this is one of those really interesting moments. And, you know, because I've got people who ask me, you know, how could you possibly support those Republicans? And the reality... Or those Democrats. The reality is the Republican Party is not the friend of workers. And it comes to these kind of things. You know, DeWine wasn't raising the bells and pushing and you know, expanding the area of containment. He's not going to be the guy who's going to hold these big corporations to the fire. He's not, because it's not what they do. Their ideology, their core belief, and this comes back down to that belief structure, that corporations are always going to do what's in the best interest of the corporation. And they believe that, you know, killing people is not in their best interest. The rail barons have never cared about people, have never cared about communities that they run through. Never. So am I surprised by any of this? No, I wouldn't be surprised by it. But the core answer is, I want a Democratic Party, and this is where you know Democrats kind of fell behind on this. Should have been demanding more. We should have seen a much more aggressive FEMA, you know, coming in, and this is a catastrophe. There should have been some reaction. I know. People have said, but you know, it's the states. I get that. I get it's DeWine. I get that the responsibility lies in the state, and the states, you know, generally have to ask the federal government to step in. I get that. But if you're the Democratic Party and you know this is going to come up and bite you in the behind, don't you take a really aggressive, strong pro-worker position? They are now. But this should have been happening in the initial days right after. And this comes back down to what I've always said. You know, I want someone who's going to stand up and fight for me and not just offer to hold my coat in a street fight. I know hate mail's coming, and you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, to send that hate mail. I do answer all emails personally. This is one of those moments, folks. Again, want to hear you.
This is Civic Media for the Fox Valley.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. A U.S. official confirming two people dead after a Black Hawk helicopter belonging to the Tennessee National Guard crashed onto an Alabama highway. El Paso, Texas police say one person has died and three others hurt in a shooting at a local mall. Buffalo supermarket mass shooter Peyton Gendron sentenced to life in prison without parole. It was an emotional hearing that included victim impact statements from family members of the 10 black residents killed.
In the end, the judge said that there would be no mercy, that his crimes were too cruel, too heinous, and she sentenced Peyton Gendron to what was required, life in prison without the possibility of parole after he had pleaded guilty to domestic terrorism motivated by hate.
ABC's Aaron Katursky. Michigan State University campus gathering for a vigil for the victims of a Monday night mass shooting.
It is okay to not be okay right now.
Undergraduate student body president Joe Kovach. This is ABC News.
Civic Media for the Fox Valley.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matnair. Here's what you need to know. A Milwaukee Bucks executive is making a new move politically. Alex Lazary ran an unsuccessful campaign for a Democratic U.S. Senate nomination last year. Now he's forming Next Wisconsin. The Political Action Committee is investing in races for mayoral and county executive positions across the state, including mayoral races in Racine, Green Bay, and Stevens Point. Snowmobile trails across most of the southern and central part of Wisconsin shut down yesterday because of worsening conditions. Langlade and Marathon County trails closed on Tuesday. Only one trail remains open in Lincoln County. There are still some open trails in the northern counties. Trails in southern and central Wisconsin may reopen if there's enough snow in the coming days and weeks. I'm Jane Matnair. This is Civic Media News. The Civic Media team would like to say congratulations. More than 200 Wisconsin businesses and nonprofits are receiving a free advertising campaign through our one-day $1 million advertising giveaway. If you missed out, our local sales team would still love to help you with your own campaign. Go to civicmedia.us and click on the sponsorship tab. Again, civicmedia.us and sponsorship. New and still growing. Advertise today with a Civic Media network of radio stations.
As goes Wisconsin.
Mandela Barnes, future runs. Not yes, not no.
You know, I'm not closing the door, right? Like, taking a loss is not easy. And it's tough, too, when it's such a razor-thin margin. You know, I know some people who just get up right away and decide they want to run again. Like,
yeah.
I'm not there. But, you know, it's all timing.
Celebrating all things Wisconsin. As goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. Weekdays 11 to 2 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app. Earl Ingram.
They can't tell you one thing that Ron Johnson has done to support them. I don't understand that. I never will understand it. I know we've got conservative listeners, but I ask them to point to one thing that Ron Johnson has done to make their lives any better, and they can't point to any of it.
Conversations that hit home every day. The Earl Ingram Show. Weekday mornings 8 to 11 on Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
What is dedication?
I think a parent's job is to protect our children, but also prepare them for the world so they become good, kind human beings.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov.
Happy Valentine's Day. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from...
Welcome back back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Still got time to partake in Banned Book Week in my local public library. Good on them. The good folks at Bosler Library are celebrating Banned Book Week from the American Library Association. All of your favorites, all of your favorite banned books right there, able for you to,
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday in Washington, D.C., the American Federation of Government Employees held a rally talking about pay, their working conditions. I had some legislators come out and join them, hundreds of workers coming out and saying, look, you made us heroes, called us frontline heroes, called us essential. We got through the pandemic. Every time there's a crisis, you hold us hostage. It's time that you treat us with the dignity and respect that our labor, that our herodom demands. That's why they're asking for a pay increase and asking for Congress to do their job and help them out. That's why I've asked Everett Kelly to come talk with us. Dr. Kelly is the national president for the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE. AFGE.org is their website. Dr. Kelly, thanks for taking time for us.
No, pleasure is mine, Rick. It's always good to be with you.
So walk me through. You had this big rally on Tuesday, pay increase. What are you guys demanding?
Well, we're seeking at least an 8.7% pay increase for this next fiscal year. And we think that it is high time, to restore the purchasing power of federal wages and salaries and market comparable to federal pay. When, the law that created locality pay for salary federal workers was passed 32 years ago, the Federal Pay Compatibility Act, or the FEPCA, right? The pay gap was about 25%. And today, it's still over 23% on average. And AFGE, we support the FAIR Act, right? The bill that's introduced by Representative Gary Connolly, and Senator Brian Schatz. H.R. 536 and Senate Bill 124 that provides a federal pay raise of 8.7% for 2024 as a means of both restoring federal employee living standards and making progress on closing part of that pay gap.
Right. Now, here's where I come down on this. We should be using our tax dollars to lift people's wages, conditions, lives up, and having something in place that wages aren't eaten away by inflation, a cost of living adjustment in people's wages should start at the federal level so that all workers eventually get this. Because I support it because, look, at the end of the day, if you're doing better, the private sector is going to have to do better. And this kind of race to the top, or at least race to the middle, seems logical and sensible to me, no?
Right, absolutely. Absolutely, Rick.
So when you're selling this to the average person, because I know my listeners are out there going, I didn't get an 8.7 raise. Why should they deserve it? They're just those lazy government workers that we've been hearing about. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, I would say that, what you probably don't know is that the federal worker are 23% behind in the pay gap, right? When it comes to other employees in like positions, we're 23% behind. Secondly, I would explain to them, what we do for the American public. We're out working for the American public. We are the ones that make sure that the veterans, that go and serve in the military, get themselves hurt, come back. We are the ones that make sure that they are taken care of. We are the ones that make sure Social Security checks go out on time and that they are processed. We're the ones that make sure that our skies are safe. We're the ones that make sure that our borders are secure. Don't you think that we deserve a livable wage if we're taking care of the American people like that?
And more importantly, I don't think you deserve it. I think you earn it.
I mean, that's,
you've earned it.
You know, this is where, you know, I don't think the American public gets what your members do. But again, there's this attack on anything public sector. There is a hard line that anything public sector is bad and that everything in private sector is right. And the reality is you guys do jobs that in the private sector they wouldn't do well. So for me, we have to have a vibrant, strong public sector, and we've got to have the kind of wages that draw people to want to stay and do these kind of jobs and do public service. It's not all charity work.
Brother Rick, you said the magic word, you know, or words, because you said a lot. You know, there, we got to make sure that people want these jobs, right? I mean, that are able to do these jobs, right? Because these are jobs that, you know, most people don't want to perform, you know, but we have very patriotic employees, you know, that love the work that they do, and they give themselves to make sure that the work is completed correctly, you know. So that's a thing that makes me proud to represent the employees that I represent.
See, for me, Everett, this comes down to, you know, I want a public sector that's not based on patronage, based on whoever's in the White House getting the best deal for their people. I want our public sector workers to be boring bureaucrats who come to work and do the best job that they can possibly do, being the best skilled, best trained, most knowledgeable workforce we can get, because you're the guys who oversee everything else. You're the guys who are regulating if our water is clean to drink, if our air is clean to breathe, if the planes aren't going to fall out of the sky, if, oh, by the way, we mandate inspections on rail cars so we don't have derailments, and if the water is going to be clean to drink after this. I don't want people depending on, hey, maybe I can go get a job on the other side because they pay better. I want to make sure the people we've got doing these jobs want to stay and make a career of serving the public and still being able to support their families.
But Rick, you know, this is exactly true. You know, we, matter of fact, today, you know, we held a rally at the EPA, right? At the central office, right? Because, you know, those are environmentalists and scientists and, you know, people like that, that do exactly what you just said. They make sure that our air quality is correct. They make sure that our water is clean, you know, and they are out saying, look, you know, we want to make sure that we have decent benefits and decent pay, you know, because people can go right down the street and get a job in the private sector, you know, making a whole lot more money than what we make. So do right by us, right? Do right by those federal employees that are very patriotic, that are very, you know, concerned about their job and want to do that job, you know, but they also want to make a livable wage so that they can take care of their families and make sure that, you know, house note is taken care of and car note is taken care of and the electric bill is paid. All of these things that come with being, you know, a family, you know, they want to be able to do that, you know, and they should be able to do that with as much ease as the next person.
Yeah, and be able to make a living and get the pride of knowing that they have a job that matters and one that still puts food on the table and a roof over their head. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Dr. Everett Kelly. He's the president of the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE.org, if there is their website, if you want to check that out. Now, Dr. Kelly, I'm looking at, you know, the coming months, and sadly, over the last, you know, decades, we've seen your members basically being the proverbial dog in every fight. The one that gets kicked in every opportunity, whether it's you know being blamed for something happening, or the next time we decide, oh, we're going to willy-nilly shut the government down. I want to get your thoughts on the debt ceiling fight, because this is coming up, and it's coming quickly, sadly. And your members are the ones who, every time this happens, are the ones who suffer and struggle through this. So I wanted to get some of your thoughts on where you see this going and what's going on.
But Rick, first of all, I must say this. Congress must raise the debt ceiling on the U.S. Treasury security without any strings attached, okay? Now, that's very key. Now, some members of Congress have announced that they will not support an increase in the debt ceiling without reduction in Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. The White House says it will not negotiate such an arrangement, and I'm glad to know that. AFGE strongly support the administration's refusal to negotiate on these matters. You know, now Congress know we need new debt whenever they approve laws that cost money or affect tax revenue. Now, most of the lawmakers, threatening to, extort Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, have voted for bills that require the issuance of new debt, showing their hypocrisy, if you ask me, along with their irresponsibilities and indifferences to the consequences their action would have for our Americans. Actually, default on debt payments and other obligations would have an enormous effect, adverse effect, on the world's economy.
Yeah, I mean, they're basically, it's come with me, if you will, for a second, because I have this thought that, and I've been, every time we have these debt ceiling fights, Republicans are always looking for their pound of flesh. I go back to Screwquester during the Obama years, where we had to get a pound of flesh everywhere. I'm now looking at the people who are negotiating this moment. I really think in this hostage situation, they really do want to shoot the hostage. I mean, I never really believed that they wanted to in the past. I really think we're at a moment where there are people who are on the Republican side who do want to shoot the hostage in this situation, which means your members get screwed over, which means the American people get screwed over, and globally, who knows what happens when we set off this bomb? I just, do you see the same kind of dynamics, or am I just being a little over the top?
You're not over the top at all, Rick. You know, as a matter of fact, I think it's very good. It's spot on, if you ask me, because, a default would raise interest rates via, downgrades of American credit ratings, leading to the waste of trillions of dollars over decades and needless high borrowing costs, right? And I believe that paying some bills and not others is not an option for avoiding this crisis. You know, the Treasury can't prioritize payments. All authorized payments are on legal footing, equal legal footing. And without raising the ceiling, $1 trillion would need to be cut from approved agency budgets already. So you're spot on, and I appreciate you, making that point. And I hope that others understand where we are when it comes to the debt ceiling.
Now, last time we shut down the government, the last couple of times we did this, how painful was it for your members? I remember talking to people who weren't, there were a number of paydays that came and went with no payday, with no paychecks. Absolutely. How painful was this?
Oh, it was very painful. I mean, people lost their homes and, because sometimes, we're federal workers. We work from paycheck to paycheck. You go 2 weeks without a paycheck, you could easily lose home, you could lose automobiles. I mean, people can't eat, can't pay the child's tuition. That means they drop out of school and all these types of things. I mean, it was very painful. It was painful for me to sit back and watch the 300,000 people that I represent, have to go through that. Now, all 300,000 wasn't affected. We know that. But they was affected inadvertently, because when they see one person hurting, guess what? All of us are hurting.
Yeah. Now, I made this point a moment ago that you and your members are basically the proverbial dog in a lot of these fights, the easy whipping boy, because you really don't have the ability to go and take on all of the attacks on the public sector, on government employees, on the government as a whole. But there's this thought out, you're just lazy, you don't want to work, which is why I point to this show-up act that the Republicans are trying to ram through or have passed in the House. I don't know that it goes anywhere in the Senate. We'll see. But, this sends a message to me that's saying that, you guys are, you're just lazy, just sitting at home, and kind of that same business mentality. We're not even really looking at metrics.
Well, and it bothered me to even fathom, the thought of someone calling the people that I represent, the union that I represent, lazy and just sitting at home and all that stuff, because I know the people that I represent. And federal employees have demonstrated great tendency and endurance in getting their work done despite all the challenges that they have faced during the last few years. First of all, that was a hostile White House, right? And then there was a global pandemic. And these employees were the ones that kept America going. And to have someone to call them lazy, it's beyond me. And it bothers me. It upsets me to even think that someone would call those federal employees that has kept this country running for the last few years lazy or incompetent. It really bothered me to the core, because I know the people that I represent.
Well, let me ask you this, Dr. Kelly, because if you watch the speeches that they gave during the Show Up Act debate, It was all about the workers working from home don't do their jobs. They're just sitting on the couch. Basically, they're just eating bonbons and watching daytime TV. Do we know how efficient some of these programs of people working from home work? Because, look, I've heard in corporate America, people have never been more efficient than where they are. Now, I have a lot of problems with telework on a whole privacy level. But from a productivity standpoint, it sounds to me like pretty damn successful. And your members really rose to the occasion.
It has been successful, Rick. And that's the part that I am really glad about. In certain departments, in certain agencies, we had backlogs and all the things going into the pandemic. All those backlogs have been cleared up. People are working, and they are, in my opinion, I'm wondering how they get all this work done in the amount of time that they have to work. But certainly productivity has gone up. Remote work, telework, it works. It works for America.
Now, are you all on board with this? I mean, obviously, I know in my world, the thought of privacy concerns keep popping up. How much control does the employer have over your home, base area? There's a bunch of that. Are you negotiating, talking about that? Or is this just, the Republicans are saying, you got to come back to the office. This is now done. It's over. Where do you see this going?
Well, what I'm glad about, Rick, is that, our union have recently negotiated updated contracts at agencies, including the EEO, the National Science Foundation, and the National Archives and Records Administration, that expand the use of employees' remote work arrangement. And I see that we will continue to fight, for the opportunity to negotiate over this issue, because we've seen it work. I mean, we have the data to prove that it works. And, we will be out there continuing to make our case for remote work.
Good stuff. Last question I've got for you. I've had a number of AFGE members tell me they don't think President Biden's moving fast enough in replacing some of the Trump era heads of departments. Because look, the president, in my view, is the most pro-union president, at least of my lifetime. I like a lot of the things he's done. A couple of things, we can have arguments about. But in your experience, what are you seeing out of this administration for your members?
Well, I do agree that President Biden is probably the most pro-union president that we have seen in my lifetime, for sure. There is some areas that cause concern. There are times when we feel that the administration is not operating swiftly enough. But I really don't think that's the president, if you ask me. I think that the president's desire is genuine. I think that he genuinely wants to be a pro-labor employer. But I think that we have some managers that just don't want to give up that power. And so they are circumventing the system that he's put in place. Yeah. That's what I truly believe.
No, I think so too. And there's a part of me goes, just need to move a little faster and rooting out some of the anti-worker, anti-government folks that we saw during the Trump years. And hey, that's what re-election is for. Or at least that's my thought. But Dr. Kelly, I appreciate the time. Keep up the great work, and I look forward to having you back again real soon.
Rick, thank you, sir. And I always know we're here for you, because you've always been there for us.
Good stuff. Thank you, Dr. Kelly. Gotta take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. We need to spend money on healthcare, schools, housing, not a war budget. This was the statement of Fred Pecker, a member of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union Local Number 6. On this day in labor history, the year was 2003. Fred, who was protesting in San Francisco, was just one of the estimated 10 million people in 800 cities across the globe that protested the U.S. war in Iraq that day. The Guinness Book of World Records declared the protests the largest in human history. The official U.S. labor response to the Iraq War, just as in wars before it, was mixed. Some unions supported the war, while others passed resolutions against it. Others stood silent, focusing on their contracts and domestic labor issues instead of taking a public stand on an international conflict. In New York City, 30 unions representing 500,000 workers publicly endorsed the February 15th protests. A month before the massive protests, anti-war unionists across the country formed the organization U.S. Labor Against the War. The coalition pushed for the AFL-CIO to take a stance against the war. Their efforts were successful 2 years later. In 2005, at their national convention in Chicago, the AFL-CIO passed a resolution calling for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. 3 years later, on May Day 2008, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union shut down the West Coast ports in protest of the war. What Fred, the longshoreman's comment on this day in 2003 revealed is that the lives of rank-and-file working people are impacted by war, wherever they or their union personally stand on the issue. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Like us on Facebook and follow us on the Twitters at LaborHistoryIn2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So, Jamie Raskin, who I love this guy. Cancer at all and the Stevie Van Zandt do-rag on his head. He is the ranking Democrat on the House Oversight Committee. He is requesting that while they're investigating children, while they're going after Hunter Biden, maybe you might want to look into the whole Jared Kushner thing. We've been talking about this for a very long time. The fact that, somehow he got $2 billion from a Saudi investment fund when the Saudi investment fund said, no, we shouldn't do this. Since we're going after the children, difference being Hunter Biden was never part of any administration, as where Jared Kushner was the guy who solved all the world's problems. In fact, I got people telling me that the best treaty ever was the Israeli UA United Arab Emirates peace deal to bring peace to the Middle East. You know that peace deal without the Palestinians? Yeah, you figure that out. I can't. But if the claim is we're bringing transparency back and this is one of those things you have to do. Now Raskin sent a letter saying, hey, this is something we should be looking into. Do you think they will? I wouldn't put any money on it. And finally, remember that famous picture of the tiki torch folks at the Unite the Right rally that ended up where Heather Heyer was murdered. Do you remember that picture? The screaming white, angry young white guys with their tiki torch and their collared shirts. One of the guys prominent in the photo, a guy named Duke Nukem after the video game. Yes, he actually changed his name from Ted Landrum to Teddy Joseph von Nukem. Evidently, at 35, he is now dead. Evidently went back down to the hay shed in his southern Missouri ranch or farm and blew his brains out. Now, there's no celebrating here. There's none of that. The fact is this is not a good guy. White supremacist, Nazi, and that's not even my problem with him. My problem with him is he was arrested back in March of 2021 for having more than 33 pounds of fentanyl pills. Now, we're pointing at those illegals because it's the illegals that, coming across the desert, evidently climbing over the fences. They're the ones bringing in the fentanyl, when the reality is it's white guys like this. 33 pounds of fentanyl. And my question is, how do you get out of jail having 33 pounds of jail of fentanyl? Now, I get it. No, everyone's got a right to bail. The guy in Philadelphia with 3 peppermint patties sat waiting for over 500 days. How does a guy with 33 pounds of fentanyl oh, wait a second, the guy with the peppermint patties was a black guy. This guy's a white guy with money and resources and an entire white nationalist, not neo-Nazi group behind him. I think we now know. But anyway, dead, his trial was about to begin. Probably didn't want to spend the rest of his life in jail. You know, as a neo-Nazi and someone who's famed with the picture, probably the right call. Probably the right call. I'm sure he's somewhere. Anyway, if you miss any portion of the program, make sure you download the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. You've got a thought, question, comment, something on your mind, email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Thanks so much for being here.
You're listening to WISS 1100 AM Berlin, W252 DR Oshkosh, and WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay.